Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. Today I'll be talking with actor-director John Fisher and actor Morgan Lang about the premiere of The Normal Heart, a play by Larry Kramer set in the early 80s about the HIV/AIDS crisis. It's at the Rhino. Also stopping by are choreographer-dancer Nati Tekek, artistic director of Nava Dance Theater, and visual artist Rupi C. Tutt, who will talk about their work Broken Seeds Still Grow, a multidisciplinary dance theater production which explores the continuing impact of the 1947 partition of British India, which created over 15 million refugees and killed over 1 million people. Also, two-time Grammy Award-winning and a good friend, Danish-American violinist and composer Mads Tolling will be in studio to share details about his upcoming concerts this Sunday at Yoshi's in Oakland, which combines music of the 60s and special guest jazz cabaret singer Paula West. Plus, Open Air's regular contributor and critic-at-large Peter Robinson will pay tribute to Fats Domino and review the movie Murder on the Orient Express in the new version directed by Kenneth Branagh. Stay with us. Larry Kramer's largely autobiographical The Normal Heart, which had its premiere back in 1985 or so, has its San Francisco presentation at the Gateway Theater, formerly the Eureka, on Jackson Street. And it stars and is directed by John Fisher, no stranger to these airwaves, along with Morgan Lang, who was recently on Open Air to talk about his role in Equus, also at the Rhino. John's recent playwriting credits include Flim Flam this past March, Shakespeare Goes to War, which was nominated for 6 Bay Area Theater Critics Circle Awards in 2016, and To Sleep and Dream. He directed and acted in Breaking the Code, about mathematician and the father of the modern computer, Alan Turing. Among his many other acting roles in Shakespeare Goes to War, directing the recent production of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert for Theater Rhino. John also appeared as Lear in Lear! Exclamation mark at the United Solo Festival in Manhattan in his one-man show, A History of World War II, as well. John, a pleasure to welcome you back to our airwaves.
Thanks, David. It's always great to be here.
Morgan Lang was last seen with the Rhino playing Edmund in the aforementioned production of Lear. Before that, and in our last conversation together, he played lead Alan Strang in the Rhino's production of Equus. He studied with ACT's studio and Young Conservatory programs, and it's a pleasure to welcome you back, Morgan.
Thanks for having me.
Well, John, let's talk a little bit about background. I mentioned that it's largely an autobiographical play that Larry Kramer did. You lived through this crisis. How do you see the play compared to your own experience?
Well, it was a shocking period to live through because, of course, nobody knew anything. And this is the time of
Where
the play.
Where were you at the time of this play?
I was in San Francisco. I was also in New York, where the play is set. And it was just like this massive mystery and horrifying because nobody knew anything. It was just like nobody knew anything. And there was nothing, there was no information. And the information going out was contradictory. So the play really captures that. It's sort of a beautiful recreation of this time of kind of horrifying mystery, as I say, but also it's a romantic play. It's an exciting play because the people involved in the play are trying to solve the problem. I think of it as like an action play, actually, because they're really trying to find a cure and trying to get information out and help people. And I think it's where the gay world really came together as a whole, unified around something other than just coming out into a crisis. And I think it's made gay men strong. I think it's what eventually led to us getting gay marriage. I think it's what's brought us acceptance. And it seemed at the time like it wasn't going to do that. It was going to kill us and empower the people who hated queer people. But in fact, I think it made homosexuality a solid force in this world. And now there's no stopping us.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Morgan, as someone who's really a generation removed from the whole crisis, as intense as it was back in the 1980s. As someone much younger, what is your perception of HIV and AIDS, both historically and in today's world? Is it just another disease that's treatable? How do you view the history and what's been going on?
Well, I was born in 1997, so, you know, it's...
Oy vey. God.
You just, for us, it was something you learned about. It wasn't like a, we met people and we saw faces, but it was something more that was talked about and wasn't really seen as much. And I think diving into this play, you just kind of see the, man, these people are just fighting to be heard and nobody wants to hear them. And it's, that's just kind of the story. It's crazy. It talks about the Tylenol cases in the story, yeah, and it's just
ridiculous.
It's absolutely ridiculous.
Well, tell us that story, John.
Well, at the same time as the AIDS crisis was emerging and everybody was getting sick, there was a Tylenol scare that killed 7 people and dominated the New York Times. The New York Times would not cover the AIDS crisis, would not cover it. The government would not do research, and everybody was freaked out about Tylenol. Not that they shouldn't be, but I mean, essentially, it was a problem. Don't take Tylenol. Don't take Tylenol. And it's easily solved. Don't pop Tylenol if people are dying from it. But nothing was being dedicated to this disease. It had thousands of cases emerging, and they were doubling every 6 months. And so the Tylenol scare is used as a sort of a horrifying example of how the New York Times can get sidetracked into something that is acceptable because it's not affecting the it is affecting the straight world, and it isn't an exclusively gay disease, which of course it emerged that AIDS, HIV was not exclusively an AIDS a gay disease. But I think it's amazing what Morgan just said. I mean, you know, he was educated in this. He got it in the schools. I mean, at the time of this play was written, you couldn't talk to people. You couldn't talk to kids about this.
Yeah, let alone anything remotely sexual, let alone homosexual.
Of course, it was seen, if you talk about AIDS, it was seen by the Reagan administration as saying being gay is good. Be gay. Be gay. Go ahead and be gay. Be gay. It's like absurd. Why would anybody think that? But that was the perception. And now Morgan, born in 2016 or something. he's getting this in the crib. I mean, he's getting educated in swaddling, and that in and of itself is a miracle. That prevention and safe sex are now a part of curriculum. I mean, when I had sex ed, it was like, you know, it was all about don't invite girls over when they're having their period to go swimming. I mean, it was like, I was like, I didn't even know what that meant. I mean, periods? I don't even have a swimming pool. I mean, I think that it's really amazing what he just said. And it just shows how far we've come, although we haven't solved all the problems of HIV/AIDS, certainly.
Well, so Morgan, getting educated about this particular disease, is it just one of other diseases? Is it just something that's treatable now to you? I mean, as you approach your daily life? Are you worried about it? Do you consider it something that has to be on your mind all the time, the way a whole generation of gay men, at least gay men, have
absolutely.
Well, straight as well as for straight people.
I think John hit it on the head. Just practice safe sex. That would be that seems to be the best solution, and I don't think it's at the forefront of thought for many people in my generation, at least. But how can I speak for an entire generation? it was just when you learned about it, you saw just how scary and terrifying it really was. And then diving into this play and being it's
an education in itself, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
You play Tommy Boatwright, who is based on the real-life character Roger McFarlane, who is the executive director of the very new organization known as Gay Men's Health Crisis, later involved in ACT UP and Broadway Cares. What did you learn about this character, Tommy, and the way he interacted with his fellow people in crisis?
I looked at Tommy as a very warm-hearted character, just trying to help in these times of trouble, trying to figure out what he can do now to actually do something. Because in times of trouble and chaos, sometimes just being able to help the people around you is all you really can do. And for me, Tommy was just... he's a character of immense love and and he has just this huge heart, and that's kind of his life purpose, is to help other people. And
Tommy's from the South. Yeah. I mean, he's the good South. He's the loving, gentle, caring South. And Morgan gives a lovely performance. He's very comical when the play needs some comedy. He brings his Southern warmth. He describes himself as a Southern bitch. And that's just what we need in this crisis. He keeps bringing perspective of humor into the piece. But he's also the great nurturer.
Mm-hmm. And John, you play Ned Weeks, which is based on, of course, playwright Larry Kramer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there's a lot of anger on display in this play.
Yeah.
In his review in the New York Times back when it first premiered, Frank Rich wrote, "In this fiercely polemical drama, the playwright starts off angry, soon gets furious, and then skyrockets into sheer rage."
That's a pretty good description of the journey. It's a real gut-wrenching trip every night. And that's interesting. He refers to it as polemic. I think when it was written, everybody thought this was just polemic. But now it's emerged, I think, as one of the great American plays. It's just a beautifully written play. There's a lot of anger in the play, but there's also romance. Ned falls in love. Ned finds somebody to hold on to. The actor who plays my husband, I just kiss and kiss and kiss every night. I'm just like, I mean, there's all this great love and romance in Ned as well, which gets lost. I mean, I think people think of all the yelling, and he did yell a lot, and I do every night, of course. But he also listens, he also cares, and he also falls in love and loses somebody. So it's sort of like this wonderful romance. I think it's emerging as one of the great American plays of the last 50 years.
And so it sounds like you're also having a little fun in the show.
I do have fun. It's like glorious fun. There's scenes with Tommy Boatwright, Morgan, which are just like fun to play because they're just fast and fast-paced, and we're trying to solve a problem. But I think what Larry Kramer put on stage was a beautifully rounded character in just the classic Ibsenian Eugene O'Neill sense, just somebody who is really human. And the anger is there, but I think he also showed that he was self-aware and he understood the mistakes he made in losing control.
You're also the director of this production. Now, who's directing John Fisher?
Well, he doesn't need direction. I get a lot of help, and I have a lot of spies. I refer to them as my spies in the audience. I said, "How's this going? How's this going?" And I said, "How's this going? How's this going?" So I get a lot of feedback, and this is just sort of the way I do things. I mean, I've always written and directed myself. Everybody says, I could never do that. I'm like, it's just how I see things. But as I say, it should say directed by me and then 50 other people. It's like the cast have helped me.
Right.
Everybody helps me. And I do get feedback, and I listen to it. And I don't always say, yes, you're right. But I do mean, yes, you're right. Because it settles in there. I'm like, you know what? They're right. I need to like stop doing this, or I need to start doing that. And it's funny. Sometimes the direction I get is like what you wouldn't expect. It's like, turn it up. Be funnier, be sillier, don't be so shy, you know, turn it on. It's like, wow, I'm holding back. You think in this situation you wouldn't hold back, but
right.
Yeah, so I do get a lot of help.
I'm curious, in your preparation for this or in the past, have you talked with Larry Kramer at all? Do you know what his current perception of current HIV treatment and prevention would be? Would it be just, it's about effing time, or is it?
No, he did two interviews for us, one for The Cron, one for the SF Weekly. I've done Facebook with him. He says it's a mess. It's a mess. It's like the drugs cost far too much money. The populations most at risk are people who can't afford, they don't have health care, and so they can't afford the drugs. And so people are still dying. That composer of Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson just died of AIDS.
Yeah.
People are still dying. No, Larry Kramer is like, and the third world, Africa, it's outrageous. And on top of that, he's got Trump to deal with. His Facebook life has exploded. You know, he's got, and he only writes in caps. If you go on, the cap lock has been on his keyboard since 1979. And then the exclamation mark is like worn through. He has to have that button replaced every year. No, Larry Kramer is 82 and going full bore. And he's not letting it go. And God love him. I think that he's done a lot, not just his play, but all of his activism has done a lot to make AIDS a crisis and keep it in the public eye.
The Normal Heart runs through the 25th at the Gateway Theater, formerly the Eureka Theater, on Jackson Street here in San Francisco. It's by Larry Kramer and stars John Fisher as Ned Weeks, aka Larry Kramer. Morgan Lang as Tommy Boatwright. Thanks, gentlemen, for coming in, and we will look forward to seeing the production at the formerly Eureka, the Gateway, 215 Jackson Street. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, David.
Still to come, a tribute to Fats Domino and Mads Tolling and Paula West at Yoshi's. Nava Dance Theater announced the world premiere of Broken Seeds Still Grow from November 16th to 19th at the Flight Deck on Broadway in Oakland. It's a multimedia collaboration between choreographer Nadi Tekek and artist Rupi C. Tutt that explores the continuing impact of the 1947 British India partition, using Bharatanatyam, live music, calligraphy, and Indian miniature painting. Those creators join me in studio today. Nadi Tekek is the artistic director of Nava Dance Theater, a San Francisco-based Bharatanatyam dance company. Nadi has performed at various venues, including Vancouver and New York City and in Salinas. She returns to Chennai, India each year to perform in multiple venues during the Chennai Music and Dance Festival. Nadi, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you, and thanks for having us.
Of course. She's joined in studio by Rupi C. Tutt, an Oakland-based visual artist, blending calligraphy and Indian miniature painting. Her work has been presented through exhibits, talks, and demonstrations in London, at Stanford University, here in San Francisco at the Asian Art Museum, and in Toronto. She's currently producing a collection redefining gender roles in major North Indian literary works. Rupi has a degree in biology from the University of California, LA, Los Angeles, and a master's in public health from Loma Linda University with a specialization in global health. She switched her career to a full-time professional artist about 5 years ago. Rupi, welcome to you.
Thanks. Great to be here.
I should have also mentioned in Nadi's introduction that you have a PhD in bioengineering from Rice University.
I do, yes.
Quite a transition from which we'll talk about in our discussion today. Well, to start off with, many of our listeners may not understand what the partition of India was all about. Could we get a little mini history lesson here?
Sure. 1947 partition of India was the time when British India was divided into two countries, Pakistan and India, and mostly it was based on division based on religion. So a lot of the Muslim citizens of India moved towards Pakistan or East Pakistan, which is now called Bangladesh, and a lot of the Hindus and Sikhs traveled towards the Indian region at that time.
So it was primarily a religious conflict that led to the division?
It was mainly, and you know, I think everybody has a different perspective on it. I feel it was mostly the leaders requiring a certain amount of land for whatever the dominant religion was in that land. However, it did impact a lot of lives who did not have a say in why and how and where those boundaries were going to be drawn, and their lives were impacted directly.
How were those borders ultimately determined?
So this is also going to be part of our show. Those borders were ultimately drawn by this guy who's brought in from England, who came and drew that line. It was called the Radcliffe line, and ultimately it was more about allocating resources that were balanced between the different regions. However, you know, for example, my family, who had family in India and Pakistan as well, they were not able to either see their family in Pakistan anymore because they were moving to India, or they were not even able to have any control over the assets they have in the country that they were not a part of anymore.
That's artist Rupi Tutt talking about her family. Nadi, was your family divided as well, or where is your family coming from?
No, actually not at all. My family, my parents and my grandparents, they're from Kerala. It's a southern region of India. And to me, I kind of had the opposite sort of experience with partition. It didn't really feel a part of my life at all growing up. I knew that there were conflicts associated with religion in terms of Hindu, Sikh, Muslim, but I grew up Christian, so it seemed pretty far away. And so my process in this inquiry has been more about discovering my history as a part of partition and as a part of my heritage. And learning about partition through working with Rupi, actually, and then working with the 1947 Partition Archive in Berkeley, and really diving into witness accounts and realizing how connected we all are to partition culturally especially, and realizing how many parallels there are from partition in society today and where we live in the United States.
Let's talk about that in a minute. But what I didn't realize, and you probably learned yourself, is that some 15 million people were displaced and over a million died in the process. Now, what sort of timeline was established for the migration of the various factors?
So with the riots that started happening between communities, because there was some unrest started happening even before when the boundaries were announced, which were announced on August 15th, which is marked as the Independence Day for India. However, riots started happening 4 months before, and there was civil unrest happening at that time. However, after August 15, 1947, migration kept happening, I think, even for a year and a half, but mostly people were moving in these huge caravans, which was when the 15 million refugees that were created. And these people were moving, I think, even directly after the line was announced. Some left before, and some kept leaving. And there was still cross-migration for a year and a half, I would say, after partition. However, that did change ultimately, yeah.
So part of this work, Broken Seeds Still Grow, is about your discovery of how partition is still affecting Indians and Pakistanis.
Yeah. I think for both of us, also, like Nadi was saying, it started with a very personal picture of the event. For me, my family, my grandparents who were displaced, and for her to just look into the event and discover more about it. And it became this larger-than-life, bigger picture, and how do we fit this event into this big picture, and also our own lives. So when we're discovering this history, we're also trying to figure out, how does that history impact us today? How can we connect to it, and how can we learn from it?
And this is, there is such a common history. I mean, before division, I mean, Indian culture goes back thousands of years.
Right, and it's you know, even subtle ways. When I grew up, where how we talk and the language I use, parts of that language are still traced back to the region where my family was from. So you're right, the cultures are still very much interconnected, and which is one of the focuses that we want to bring in with Broken Seeds Still Grow, is that the communities that were separated or marked as being different are, at the end of the day, living here in the United States in the same area and same region, and we all share certain practices, traditions, whether it's across, you know, Indian, Pakistani, Bangladeshi, all of us have very more similarities than differences. And when we are here living in the U.S., we are able to take advantage of those commonalities and survive and also pursue immigrant dreams that we all come with into this country.
Rupi talking there. As you visit various communities, do you still see a division of culture and of, oh, you're Pakistani, oh, you're Indian? You know what I mean?
I think it depends. Like for me as an American living in the diaspora, when I meet another South Asian kid, we kind of get put in the same sort of bucket. I don't know. I don't feel that we're that different, which I think is kind of ironic given the history of how divided the countries were at the time. But I feel like here we're a part of the same community. And I think that's what's kind of interesting about going into this project. We're looking into partition and it's, there's so much division. And here we are in a country when we all have to be one community. And and then talking more about that is a lot of what we realize is that the hate crimes and things like that that are happening against South Asians in this sort of political climate kind of also makes us feel like we're one, you know, that we have to sort of be in this together and do something about it. I don't know.
I think the one difference that I enjoy noticing between those communities is the different languages that are part of those communities, are part of the rich heritage. For example, even for Broken Seas, we've done research where we've not only gotten witness accounts which were originally in different languages, so it might have been in Bangla, might have been in Punjabi or Hindi or Urdu, but taking those accounts and then having them being translated in English and using them towards this cohesive picture we're trying to build. And also, the poetry that we sourced was written in Urdu, in Bangla, Punjabi, English. And the different perspectives that came out of all those poets, you know, and their reflections on partition of 1947, it's really informed our perspective. So that difference I definitely enjoy, because a person from a poet from Bangladesh who wrote about, you know, losing his homeland at that point and his approach to his homeland and his unique perspective was very different from a poet who wrote about, you know, losing or seeing the bloodshed that happened in Punjab during the crossing of the different caravans. So that difference I definitely enjoy even today, and I think that's why calligraphy of these languages is part of Broken Seas for us. The communities are united here, and we're hoping that even the gaps that are still there are something that can be bridged to work towards a similar goal.
Nadi, you're using a modernized version of classical South Indian dance form called Bharatanatyam. Could you tell us a little bit about the origin of that dance and how you've changed it?
Sure. Well, Bharatanatyam is a classical Indian dance form from South India. It's originally believed to be danced by the gods and passed on to humans to understand universal truths. So it goes back centuries. And originally, like early forms of the dance were danced in temples, actually. But the way it is now, it's a performance art. It's evolved in a lot of different ways. It primarily uses mime, which is hand gestures and facial expressions to express different ideas and emotions, and then also has this technical dance element, which might look more like modern or ballet, where they're just literally dancing around, and it's quite rhythmic. And so what I do and what Bharatanatyam does is uses these elements to tell a lot of different stories. And I don't think I modernize it in any way. It's my vocabulary. It's my language. It's my medium. It's what I choose to work with. And so I don't think I have the authority necessarily to change it or to bring other forms into it. But I use it, and I use it to express ideas that are personal to me. And in a way, I want to use that to connect with my audience and to connect to different people with the stories I want to tell. So that's what we're trying to do with Partition. And we're trying to tell the stories of Partition from our perspective and use the art forms to do it.
Rupi, you have some beautiful artwork, particularly in the way of calligraphy. I also love the way you incorporate the calligraphy into your drawings of birds. It's quite beautiful. Now, what sort of imagery did you create or are you using for Broken Seas?
Well, I would love for people to come to the show and see it. I think through calligraphy, because words have such a strong significance even when it comes to partition, most of the accounts that we're using are not part of any history books. So for us, those accounts are very important. With calligraphy, I feel honoring also the languages that those people spoke that they might have lost parts of. And I would not want to give away how it's directly being used, but what we're trying to capture is the essence and the emotion of that statement, or the essence and the emotion of a certain account from a witness, and trying to translate that into not only a visually striking image, but also an image that has, you know, language that's intact, that makes sense, and honoring the structure of that language. For me, that's very important.
Part of the unifying element is the music of composer and flautist G.S. Rajan in creating an original musical score. Tell us about what he's doing. Nadi, please.
So what we do, so Rajan and I have been working together for many years, and he has a very special gift. He's able to translate emotion and what the story is into ragams very specific to that emotion. And so we come to him with the emotions of partition. One of the pieces that Rupi talked about a little bit, it's called When I Return, and it's a poet writes about his childhood in a country that he can't visit anymore. And I'm like, Rajan, can you bring nostalgia and hope but also sadness into this piece? And he does. And so he's able to capture the story we want to say through dance and through visual art, and he's able to translate it into music. And I think he's quite good.
I think for me, not being so musically knowledgeable, I did love how Rajan brought in different elements of the different regions that partition was impacted by. So it's not music that's rooted in only one region of India, because that can also vary so much. But we have this language of music speaking the essence of, you know, the region of Punjab and the region of Bangladesh. But at the same time, us living here in California, we can still connect to that nostalgia and that one piece that he's composed for us that opens the show.
How did you guys meet? Yeah.
I went to college with Rupi's husband. We were both engineers.
I just heard about this really awesome person that I should meet that's friends with Raj. And I was like, okay, well, I want to meet her. And I think when we both met, we were both pursuing our scientific fields. And later, when we both changed our careers and then met again, we were just really in awe of the fact that both of us are pursuing these traditional arts that have their own limitation and rules. But also enjoying that and pursuing it full time, which is not something that, you know, artists are commonly doing from what I've experienced so far. So that's how we met.
Very nice. It's Rupi Tutt. We're working with choreographer Nadi Tekek in the world premiere of Broken Seeds Still Grow. We're going to hear the music of Rajan, original music score from Broken Seeds, as we thank you both for coming in today. And we'll look forward to the production.
Thank you, David.
Thank you so much.
Broken Seeds Still Grow runs November 16th through 19th at the Flight Deck on Broadway in Oakland. Go to brokenseeds.com to learn more. Music from Broken Seeds Still Grow by G.S. Rajan. At the Flight Deck in Oakland. Still to come, Peter Robinson on Fats Domino and a movie review. But first, Sherman set the Wayback Machine for 1960s America. But Mr. Peabody, never mind, Sherman, don't ask questions. Thank you. violinist Mads Tolling and Company from his recent CD, Mads Tolling and the Mads Men Playing the 60s. Also, the name of a show he'll do twice this Sunday at Yoshi's in Oakland with guest vocalist Paula West. My friend Mads is a two-time Grammy Award-winning violinist and last year's winner of the Downbeat Critics Poll Rising Star Award. He's a former longtime member of Stanley Clarke's band and the Turtle Island Quartet. And in 2014, Mads was commissioned by Michael Morgan and the Oakland Symphony to write a violin concerto, which was premiered at the Paramount Theater to much fanfare in 2015. Mads' CD, Playing the 60s, was in the top 30 for 2 months straight on U.S. jazz radio. And with his quartet, he's created a fun and exciting show that goes along with that CD that touches on the nostalgic as well as the contemporary and includes timeless movie themes, popular TV classics, and celebrated songs, ranging from Mission Impossible, The Good, Bad, and the Ugly, and yes, The Flintstones, to timeless classics like Georgia on My Mind and A Taste of Honey, which in this case will feature a collaboration with the aforementioned internationally renowned vocalist Paula West, who, like Mads, has been featuring music from the 60s in her acts, from Bob Dylan and Pete Seeger and beyond. Mads, such a pleasure to welcome you back to our studios.
Thanks so much, David. I appreciate it.
Well, you seem to be the master of all media for this show on our Bay Area jazz station, KCSM. I caught your video appearance on Channel 12's Bay Area Focus program. Good for you. Making the rounds.
Yeah, making the rounds. It makes it more fun, actually, for me, too, is getting out there and talking about what I'm about to do is important. You know?
Well, tell me how you met up with Paula West.
Yeah, it's a brand new thing with Paula, and to be honest, tomorrow will be the first time that we really get together and really work it out. But, you know, we've been going back and forth about repertoire. She's done albums of Bob Dylan's music that really inspired me to think, that ties perfectly in with the 60s. So that's going to be part of the show on Sundays, is some of Bob Dylan's material and music.
Mm-hmm. Is this same incarnation of the show, along with some of your original tunes, what you've been taking really all over the map this year, from the farthest reaches of the U.S., like Sellersville and Willow Street, Pennsylvania,
yeah.
Sioux Falls, Godfrey, Illinois, a big Scandinavian tour, and closer to home here in Half Moon Bay and Cloverdale, having fun, I imagine.
Yeah, it's been going really wild this year in terms of the traveling. I've also gone to Japan to play with a wonderful symphony orchestra where I played my violin concerto that you just mentioned earlier, and then Dubai was on the itinerary as well.
I saw some of your posts, man. It sounded like a trip.
That's a wild place, Dubai. I mean, it's just everywhere you look, they're building, you know, it's kind of fun as a musician. You get to go places you may normally not go otherwise, and so you get to see parts of the world that are kind of interesting.
Neat. And with the same guys in the band?
This is a little bit different, I mean, in terms of the travels I do, but on Sunday it's going to be the Mads Men. In this case, it's going to be John R. Burr on piano, Dan Feisley on bass, and Colin McDaniel on the drums, who are just fabulous Bay Area musicians I think folks will like very much.
Nice. Well, you brought your fiddle with you. Can we hear a tune?
Sure, why not? So this is one by the great pianist Bill Evans. And he played this one with Miles Davis, one of the most celebrated jazz melodies, called Blue and Green.
Great violinist Mads Tolling in the studios of KLW. Thank you. Great stuff. Violinist Mads Tolling in the KLW studios. Good for you. I hope the Grammy people are listening, because that's going to be worthy of another one. Good for you. That's beautiful. What was that again?
That was Blue and Green by Bill Evans. Officially, see Miles Davis, but that's because Miles took all these guys that he played with and put his name on the compositions that he made. But he recorded that with Miles back in 1959, and it was on Kind of Blue, which was still to this day the most popular jazz album of all time.
It's a wonderful album, really.
Blue
is.
Green, yeah.
Hey, I noticed that you're going to be doing a little bit of Bacharach David on this program with Paula West. How about we do a little spontaneous, Look of Love.
Look of Love. Ah, that's a great idea. I happen to have recorded that.
So, great tune.
Let's see.
Find a key that works for me here.
Yeah, what's a good key for you?
Let's see.
Maybe this?
That might work, yeah.
You want to do it?
Yeah, give me a little setup there.
Cool. Let's do it.
The look of love is in your eyes, a look your smile can't disguise. The look of love is saying so much more than just words could ever say. And what my heart has heard, well, it takes my breath away. I can hardly wait to hold you, feel my arms around you. How long I have waited just to love you. Now that I have found you, don't ever go, don't ever go. I love you so, don't ever go. Nice. Thanks for indulging me. Now, I'm no Paula West. Paula West, known for her incredible, rich, powerful contralto voice and her unique interpretations of such wonderful artists as Simon and Garfunkel, Bacharach David, Woody Guthrie, Glenn Campbell. You should have quite a fun time selecting what tunes to do with her for this weekend show.
Yeah, we've been working it out, and I think folks in for some surprises, as well as besides, you know, some of the Bob Dylan that she's done and Paul Simon.
Well, she's become quite a Manhattan fixture as well.
Yeah, she plays a lot over there. Actually, one of her albums was a live album from one of the famous clubs called the Standard, Standard over in New York.
Mads Tolling with his group, John Burr on piano, Don Feisley on bass, and Colin McDaniel on drums with special guest Paula West, is at Yoshi's in Oakland this Sunday for two shows. Go to yoshis.com or to keep up with the indefatigable Mads Tolling and his many activities, go to his website, madstolling.com. That's Mads, TOLLING.com. So after Yoshi's, what kind of gigs are you looking forward to in the year ahead?
Well, David, I'm going to be going to Scandinavia once again, pretty much right after Yoshi's, and do a tour in northern Sweden. I think we're going to go north of the polar circle. So, you know, from Dubai and the 115 degrees, we're going to go to minus 10 or so, you know.
Catch some northern lights, no doubt.
Yeah, yeah. And we actually saw that earlier this year in Tromsø in Norway. So we're going to go there and then back to Japan in December. I have a show in Tokyo that I'm going to do and some workshop for Yamaha as well. So that's what I have to look forward to. And I'm also very excited about doing a collaboration with the Pacific Chamber Orchestra, where I'm going to be writing a piece for them, a piece that will premiere in April at the Bankhead in Livermore and another venue, Lafayette. And that's going to be exciting, you know, sort of like what I did for Oakland, writing a jazz piece, jazz-influenced piece. I'm going to bring that to the table for yet another orchestra here in the Bay Area.
All right, well, we'll have to have you back for that. Thanks for coming in,
Mads. Thank you very much, David.
Keeping up with the 60s theme of this Sunday's show, I think you'll recognize this tune. It's from Lalo Schifrin and the theme to Mission Impossible. Creative interpretation of Mission Impossible by the Mads Tolling Quartet. Mads and the incredible bass work there of Sam Bevan. Well, from Mads, we go to Fats.
I found my thrill.
And a tribute to the late, great Fats Domino and Peter Robinson. Welcome back, Peter.
Hi, David. Yeah, good to be here. And those indeed are the rhythms of Fats Domino, who died just at the end of October, October the 24th, just over a couple of weeks ago. And I think one of the reasons that people, you know his music but may not know him is that he was really a very humble and shy person when actually being interviewed or speaking to. But of course, when he was hitting the keyboards, he definitely moved. He had a rhythm. He had a moving fingers. They really jumped around. And I think above all, he had a wonderful, wonderful smile, a smile almost like the keyboard on an open piano. In the 1950s, when I was first listening to rock and roll, his international reputation was already across Europe, apart from being popular in this country. And that song, Blueberry Hill, in fact a 1940 song by Vince Rose, became one of the great classics that he would go on to play. In the course of his lifetime, he sold more than 65 million records. His main period was with Imperial Records in the 1950s. And I was fortunate enough to see him when he was beginning to fade in 1968 on a trip to New Orleans in the French Quarter, where he was playing at actually a small bar. And I came in after he had started playing. He'd gone into his repertoire, and I managed to get over and actually speak to him, and I said, Fats, I thought you could use his first name like that. I missed the opening number, and he said to me, ain't that a shame? And I realized then that's what he was actually talking about. And so
chances are he's used that line many times in his career.
And so he definitely gave me a personal rendition. of Ain't That a Shame, which I think at the end of this we're just going to hear a section from. In 1998, President Bill Clinton awarded him the National Medal of Arts. And then this was repeated again by President George W. Bush. So he's there on the White House list of great achievements. And in fact, he was born in the 11th District in New Orleans, which got hit hard by the Hurricane Katrina. And once again, he jumps back to life again, trying what he can to popularize the need for help. So to me, Fats Waller is a legacy. He influenced John Lennon in some of his music, but to me, he's still the immortal Fats Waller. And why don't we hear just a little section of Ain't That a Shame?
Indeed, ain't that a shame that he did pass so soon.
You made me cry when you said goodbye. Ain't that a shame? My tears feel like rain. Ain't that a shame? You're the one to blame. You broke my heart when you said we'll part. Ain't that a shame? My tears feel like rain. Ain't that a shame? You're the one to blame.
Late great Fats Domino leaving us this past October 24th at the age of 89. Thank you for that tribute, Peter.
Yeah, and I may accidentally have called him Fats Waller. In fact, his name, Fats Domino, was based originally on an association with Fats Waller, but that was indeed Fats Domino. So we're going to move from New Orleans now to the Orient Express. And if you think you've seen it, you haven't seen this one because it comes out next week. It's directed by Kenneth Branagh, and he is at the center of the action playing Hercule Poirot, which he does with a sort of interesting Belgian French accent, so you have to listen up carefully, otherwise you may miss some of the tricks of the pronunciation. And I, of course, immediately flash back to Maurice Chevalier and Saint-Gervais for Little Girls. Well, this is a thriller based on the 1934 really detective story by Agatha Christie. It's been redone a number of times, and in fact in 1934 there had been an earlier movie based on a Graham Greene story called Stamboul Train. So we're back in the era of trains when all sorts of things happen, and like earlier versions of the Orient Express, it is indeed a star-studded cast. Part of the joy of seeing the film is to see if you can place who's who. Judi Dench plays a Russian countess with all the dignity that she brought to Queen Victoria. Penelope Cruz is in there, this time playing a Spanish missionary, which was a small change in the script. The original Ingrid Bergman played a Swedish missionary. And Derek Jacobi. So we have a story of a cast of characters who are or not guilty, and I won't give away the ending. Now, one lucky thing is that there's enough people in the young generation who haven't seen the first three versions, so the surprise ending will leave you in one of those areas of what does it all mean. Now, I say what does it all mean because this is one movie you don't want to go to sleep halfway through. The plot is convoluted, a little calculated, but still a surprise ending. And the other thing to note about this is the cinematography. It's shot in 65mm, which is the old version, the sort of photography they use for Lawrence of Arabia. So you get these huge, wide landscapes opening in the opening scene at the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem. And I think that's one of the better scenes. It gets you interested from the beginning. But then halfway through, they change to what I'm going to call digital photography. And there are some scenes as the train passes through mountainsides and kind of snow-cupped mountains that you feel definitely were put together in a studio. So I liked, when we're on 65mm, I liked that big screen, the Technicolor effect. I was kind of sidestepped when we started shooting what looks like digital footage. And Kenneth Branagh here not only directs, but he plays Poirot, the Agatha Christie detective, and he plays it as a kind of godlike character who makes moral judgments apart from making criminal judgments. And I think that's sort of interesting, because you have the dilemma of the cast: can they live with their sins? And you have to find out what sins they have committed. But also the detective: can he live with his judgment? So this is a remake. Sidney Lumet did the original one a couple of years ago. Then we've had a BBC television version. So the Orient Express has been exceedingly well travelled. But for a holiday movie where people want to see interesting actors play different parts, this is a recommendation, and it's for all generations. People who don't know the story, people who don't know the ending, and then people who may simply enjoy the new version of glamorous photography shot well against interesting landscapes. The movie Murder on the Orient Express opens next week in the Greater Bay Area, directed by Kenneth Branagh, who's also at the center of the action as Hercule Poirot.
A star-studded cast accompanies Mr. Branagh, including Penelope Cruz, Derek Jacobi, as you mentioned, Tom Bateman, Johnny Depp as well as in the cast. Should be a lot of fun. Thanks for that, Peter. See you next time.
Good. Thank you, David.
Open Air is produced by Neil Swinkles. Our shows are archived at kalw.org. Send me a suggestion if you'd like someone featured on Open Air. My email address is david@kalw.org. Thanks for listening.